This is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Sean Vanneman and Jesse Stern. Sean was the co-project leader and lead writer on Season 1 of Telltale's The Walking Dead and Puzzle Agent 2. He was also a writer on Tales of Monkey Island and a designer on Wallace and Gromit's Grand Adventures. Following Telltale, he co-founded Campo Santo and was the writer for their first game, Firewatch. Jesse was a writer on Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare and its sequel, Modern Warfare 2, as well as Battlefield 4 and Titanfall 1 and 2. And thank you two for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is fun.
It remains to be seen if this is fun. It's currently fun, but we're about 4 seconds in, so
yeah.
We'll see.
Okay.
I'm just teasing.
To take a nosedive on the fun part of this podcast, we'll start with how you two broke in.
Let's be serious for a second.
Yeah.
No more fun. The fun and games is over.
Sean, you've talked about how you've broken in many times, so I think we might just skip you.
Okay, cool. Let's move on.
Yeah.
I don't know the answers for him.
All right, fine. Sean, how'd you get into the industry?
I got in the industry. I was like needed a job when I was in college, and I started working at Disney, and they had a games group that was run by a cool guy named Chris Takami, and I was just his intern for a while, and I learned about weird third party development and publishing there, and I went, oh, I don't think this is for me at all. And then I
why wasn't it your thing?
Because it sucks. That sucks hard. I've always just wanted to make projects with people, and it's real hard to make stuff at a company that's as big and as codified as Disney. And then also it's like third party development and third party in an internal second party, I guess, development, and then third party publishing is all just really challenging because of the business structure of those deals and who has creative control. And there's so many meetings and reviews, and like, you don't just pitch your game like to like the publisher and the creatives at the publisher. You end up like pitching your game or having someone else pitch your game to like Best Buy and Target and stuff, because you're making this like $60 million game that's got to get bought in at retail, and they need to like it before you're even done with it. It's just not a good life, man. I was writing a lot and thought that I would probably switch to something like TV or film that was harder to be successful in, but a more like codified role. And I kind of knew where the boundaries were for like what type of control I would have. At least while I was writing, I could sit there in front of a script and write. And this is also like in 2006. So like, there wasn't really like a good, like, model for what someone with my skill set could do. Like this is like pre-Unity. But I got a great opportunity to go to Telltale Games in the Bay Area and work on like episodic adventure games. I loved adventure games, and I kind of just built my career there.
Were you hired as a writer at first at Telltale?
They weren't hiring writers. They hired game designers who could write. That was like the job description. So I went in as just like a puzzle designer, and then I was also responsible for writing all the dialogue for everything that I worked on. So I didn't work on a game there that I didn't also then turn around and write the dialogue on. So including like something like Poker Night at the Inventory, which Jake and I helped co-create. Yeah.
Do I ask about FK Mickey now?
Yeah.
Oh, really? You want to? I feel like okay, so look, this is, I have a very brief podcasting career, but I feel like maybe we tease Epic Mickey here, and then, you know, later we return to it because it's with a don't touch that dial addendum.
All right. Yeah. While we tease your work on Epic Mickey's idea think tank.
Warren Spector's Epic Mickey.
Yes, please. Warren Spector's Epic Mickey.
Jesse, how did you break in?
Yeah.
It was kind of an accident, really. One of the very few times in my career that an agent really opened a door for me, basically started my career. I was signing with a new agency. Like I was changing agencies, and And they kept asking, do you want the dog and pony show, you know, like Entourage, where you come in and they've got a PowerPoint presentation that's like BMW, McDonald's, Jesse Stern, you know, we're going to make a brand out of you. And it was all just hysterical. And I went to CAA for the dog and pony show, and there was, I don't know, a dozen agents around this table and all sitting very quietly, except for this one guy's name's Larry Shapiro. And he just goes, yeah, you want to write video games? And he just threw a couple of copies of, I think it was Call of Duty 2 and The Sims, across the table at me. And then he got up and left. He was like, yeah, if you want to write video games, let me know. And he left, and I turned to the other people in the room. I was like, who's that guy? Is that a real thing? So I ended up signing with them. And like 6 months later, I was coming off of like back-to-back-to-back failed TV shows. And I was a little tired of, you know, not being able to decorate my office. And I called up Larry and I said, were you serious about that video game thing? Like, is that a job people do? And do I have to go in every day? And he said, I'll set you up. So I went in for a meeting. At the time, it was Infinity Ward. And I didn't know what they were working on, but it was Call of Duty 4. And they showed me all this stuff. They showed me like a nuclear explosion and you know, a bunch of screen caps of potential levels, and they had kind of an outline of what it was going to be about. And I looked at all the stuff and I said, this is so cool. Where does it all come in the game? And they said, we don't know. Why don't you tell us? So I went home and I wrote a 3-page treatment basically of what the story could be based on what they had. I was like, I think this would be great if you moved it up here. I think this would be great if you put it in the middle. You're going to need to have an emotional connection to the character, so we got to establish that before we kill him in a nuclear explosion. I don't know how this thing ever fits in here, so I'd lose it. And I sent this thing in and heard absolutely nothing, like not even a confirmation that they'd received the email. And then 4 months later, I was working on NCIS. And I got a call from my agent and he said, hey, we got an offer for you. And I was like, an offer on what? I haven't taken a meeting in 4 months. And they said, yeah, that video game thing. They said they want to do what you said. So come in and make it happen. And that was the beginning. And that actually was like, it turned out to be an incredible experience where I had no idea what I was doing, which helped a little bit because I would propose things that were ludicrous and we'd try to figure out how to do it. Working with that team was, you know, magic. I love those guys. I still work with those guys, almost exclusively. And it worked out and we did it again. And then I, you know, next thing you know, people thought I was a video game writer and I didn't want to correct them.
That's awesome.
It was fun.
It's also really cool to like go in with no, like, especially from the outside, just the fact that you didn't have any expectations about what it should be. It's like, oh, well, you know, in most video games, you do X. Therefore, we should do X. Being able to come in from the outside and go, this is just seems better to me because of like my sensibilities of what's good in a story can oftentimes yield like really like good results, right?
Well, let me tell you where I was coming from at the time was I had been a video game junkie my entire life, right up until the point where I realized I was spending no time trying to work as a writer. And I did math and was like, okay, if I stop playing video games and use that time to write instead, I bet something will happen. So I quit playing video games. I think it was like around the time, I think the last game I was addicted to at that time was Time Splitters 2.
Oh man.
Wow.
Oh, I was so OCD on that game. I was just like trying to, you know, it's like the same logic of chasing the ghost in Mario Kart. I was just trying to get the perfect run on level by level. And I quit and started writing. Next thing you know, I had a writing career. 5 years later, I hadn't touched a video game at all. So I go into work on what turns out to be Modern Warfare, and I hadn't even looked at them. I didn't know what was going on in the video game world, and everything was – it looked like the future to me. And I didn't have the lexicon. Like, you know, the people in the room are referencing, you know, all sorts of Gears of War and Halo and all these things that I had skipped. And I'm referencing GoldenEye almost exclusively, you know, and it kind of put me in this funny position where, you know, I was speaking a slightly different language, and where we managed to overlap, we, we'd come up with really good stuff.
So did Infinity Ward people, when you got hired, did they try to give you like a refresher on how games have evolved since when you left? Or did you go out and do that yourself?
They would, you know, people would give me stuff to take home and play. And I kind of slipped back into the mode I was in when I was in college. And I wanted to see how Resident Evil ended, but I didn't want to play it. So I would like get someone else hooked on it and make them play. And I would just sit on the couch and watch. Because Resident Evil scared the crap out of me. I didn't want to play that alone.
Yeah.
And I had a buddy who was living at my house, and I would just come home and hand him a game, and he would start playing it. And I'd, you know, just cool out on the couch and watch everything that was happening. I couldn't even work the controller at the time. I really had to go to boot camp. After Modern Warfare came out and all my friends' little brothers were murdering me online, I really had to go to boot camp. And by the time Modern Warfare 2 came out, I had gone full junkie again. And I actually left my job for 6 weeks in the middle of a season to do nothing but play Modern Warfare 2.
I want to go like backtrack a bit to how you got into games, Jesse, with just that insane meeting of you want to write video games and throwing The Sims and all that across the table. Do you think that still happens, or was that a common thing that happened, or were you a rare example that happened?
I ran into around that time, that was around the same time Sean's talking about. It was 06, I think. And around that time, there was just starting to be more and more people reaching out from the video game community to, you know, TV and movie community to try and find writers, directors, actors, which is now pretty commonplace.
Yeah, but it feels like, yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
There wasn't, like Sean said, an instruction manual. Like, nobody knew how to do it, and it seemed like every game people were reinventing the wheel somehow. We don't even, you know, you get a very specific set of kind of mechanics to tell story, and you're trying to make the gameplay lead everything and make the gameplay as good as possible. So it was an interesting challenge to how can I fit story into, you know, the existing mechanics? How can I tell story through what's happening here? And TV was good prep work for that. It definitely helped.
Yeah, one of my good friends, her name's Laura Jackman. She's a writer on the new FX series Get Shorty, and she does video game contract work. Like, I think some of that stuff she like tracks down herself, but also she has an agent, and I think like that stuff still kind of happens for like working writers who have like the literacy, you know. And like some, I mean, it's a kind of a testament, Jesse, to yourself, but like some writers who come from a like TV or film get sort of a taste of video game writing, especially the stuff that's like more, that can be like more like story branching, and go like, nope, once they do it, you know. Gary Whitta and I are close, having worked on The Walking Dead together. And I think like after he delivered his script for episode 4 of Walking Dead season 1, he was like, well, that was fun. I don't know if I'll be doing that again. Those games were so branching heavy that I think it was hard for, it's just a lot of work.
Especially mindset. If you're used to, you know, the process, you know, catering to the story that you're trying to tell.
Like exactly.
The thing that's so traditional in TV and film is that you're starting from the script. People used to ask me what the job was, because, you know, it's a ludicrous job to even exist. And I would say it's basically like if someone said, okay, we're making a movie. We've got $100 million, no script, but we're going to start building a saloon set. We're going to build an interior space station set, and we're going to build an exterior street scene. And that's all built. Now, can you find a story that comes up with a way to link all those things together, and it's really good? And it's just a strange backwards process a lot of the times.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think like I was having a conversation with someone recently about why story in games kind of blows. And I think oftentimes it's just you need someone with a storytelling sensibility, even if it's not like the actual pure writer. You need someone with a really strong storytelling sensibility in a senior leadership role. because there's really no way around like the way like video game studios are built, right? Like we have this art team and like they got to work and they got to like be making stuff because they can't just be waiting around for like my perfect script to emerge. But like right now, Jane and Claire and Jake are building shippable art for a game that I haven't written yet, but there are certain things I know are going to be in the story. So I can like really organically move in and out of like actual game writing that I'm doing every day and giving notes and feedback on things like that saloon set or that space station that are just being built because we have the time and money and need to keep moving forward across all the disciplines. And because I like am a senior person at the studio, I can organically keep shaping that every aspect of the process to optimize towards the story I know I'm trying to figure out. And obviously like that means we are probably going to end up like cutting some stuff or redoing some stuff because we started too early. But it's way different than being like in the situation that you're describing, Jesse, where, okay, well, we've built all these cool scenes. We should probably go find a writer now. Like that never works. It never, ever works.
Yeah. I turned down a few jobs that were basically that were like, okay, we've built 90% of the game. Now we're ready for a story. And it's just like, I don't think that's going to play the way you want it to.
Yeah. Coming off The Walking Dead, I like quit my job and we were like organizing about how we were going to start Campo Santo. And I took a couple contracts doing basically that. And they were great contracts. They helped me out in terms of being able to like pay my rent and other things. Yeah, man, it was a real eye opener to being like, oh guys, like, No. It's like there's no writer good enough to pull off the sort of magic that you guys are like describing here. Like, yeah, I can't make a 4-course meal out of like bologna and then also like a turkey and then also like you have all these very disparate parts. I don't really know what to do here.
Do you think that's the norm?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I mean, you tell me. Like, you guys play a lot of games. Like, you can tell. Like, you can tell. I really believe you can look at most games and you can go, like, was a writer or someone with storytelling sensibilities in charge, at least of their part, or were they subservient to a creative director or a senior designer? I mean, like, if you look at just like a handful of some of the best game stories ever told, you generally have a game writer like towards the top, like big stuff like BioShock. You have Ken. Then you have like smaller stuff like 80 Days. Like Meg Giant is right there. Amy Hennig, Tim at Double Fine. That's just like it's. And right now Neil Druckmann at Naughty Dog. I mean, like these are like the gold standard of game stories, right? Mark Laidlaw on the Half-Life series. Eric Wolpaw on Portal. Not that they have like a top of the team at a place like Valve, but the flat structure allows writing to be as important as code. And it's pretty obvious to me. It's like, this is like super obvious. I'll play a game and the story will be really good. And I'm like, oh, either this writer was a senior member of the team and there from the beginning or a real asshole. Like, or really knew how to just like force feed good shit into a broken system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although that doesn't mean the story's going to be good anyway. It's just like there's a greater chance it'll be good if you involve the story person from the beginning all the way.
Yeah, yeah. It's like pre-K or something. Like if you want your kid to have a chance, like make sure that they're like, going to kindergarten and stuff. Yeah.
You know, I think the important skill to have in that position from a narrative point of view is you have to be flexible. Like you have to have a lot in reserve. And you have to be, I think, early on, not concerned that you can roll with the punches as things are evolving.
Sure.
Because in the early stages of developing a game, you want your designers to feel completely free to experiment and come up with things that are just cool, that are just fun, whether it's a way of moving or a piece of art or how the game is going to look or feel. And you don't want them to feel hemmed in by some narrative decision that's already been made. But you do want them to feel a level of security that somebody, like you said, Sean, like somebody with a strong narrative sense is watching all of these pieces with at least a vague idea of how they're going to come together. And then if they start developing side by side, you know you're in a good shape when they start feeding off of each other.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
When the art starts getting ideas from the story, when the story starts getting ideas from the gameplay, and the things start feeding together, and you kind of hit this, you know, cold fusion reaction, and that's when you get those elevated levels of, damn, this is a good story in a game.
Yeah, and it just makes like going to work fun, and like it makes it like it's like kind of like the way it like should be. And, you know, you develop that over, like, sometimes it's organizationally and most of the times, especially like at Campo Santo, it's just like, we just have like mutual trust across all the disciplines. Like everyone just sort of almost to a fault trust each other to be like cognizant of what the other people are working on. And then also be doing something that's going to amaze everyone else. Yeah.
You know, the only way, that's an interesting point. The only way to get to that level of trust is you actually have to do it once.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you're able to establish that with the Infinity Ward now Respawn team.
Yeah. I mean, that was a really fun relationship. I mean, my connection there was mostly with, you know, Jason West and Vince Zampel at the time, and Steve Fukuda and Mackie McCandlish. And a couple other guys, Zed Riki and Todd Alderman, who was doing the multiplayer. And I would just show up in this conference room, and they would put up, you know, level by level, where are we at? And if we hit a level that didn't seem like it was fitting in, we would call the level designer into the room. And that was always a funny process, because I don't know that they knew that they were dancing for their lives in that room. But they would come in, and we'd be like, what's this level about? And if someone was like, oh, I don't know, you know, there's a tank and a roll over here. If that happened, the second they left the room, we were like, okay, let's put this thing aside for a second.
Right.
But then the designers who came in, and there was a couple in particular, like Mo Alavi, who's at Respawn now, was one of the most animated human beings I'd ever seen. And he would come into that room, and he would just be so fired up about what he was building and dancing that by the time he left the room, we're like, all right, well, he's going to figure that one out. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You establish, like, being able to like tell the story of the thing you're working on and like why it's exciting to you generates so much trust in everyone else that like it's so necessary, because everything about making a video game is like effectively impossible.
Yeah.
It's incredibly, incredibly hard. And they don't reveal themselves to you very easily. Like, you have to be able to see the final product in, like, these, like, fleeting moments. Like, for me, sometimes, like, a voice actor will just deliver a line, and I'll be like, okay, fine, thank God, I can see that entire 5 minutes now, just in that one line. I can see how that was delivered, that everything's going to, like, pivot off of that one moment. Like, thank Christ that happened. Other times, you're just sitting there for months watching things, like, kind of come together, but just sort of be, like, a shambling husk of a thing that's, and it's not good, and it's buggy, and unless you really trust the process, like you'll flip out, and you'll start doing stuff where you're like, we got to redesign this entire moment, oh, we got to cut all this because it's not working. And you got to just like we have a mantra, and we even had it on Walking Dead, which was really hard, even on like at our level, we weren't at the ultra senior level at the studio, that was just like, trust the process. Like, we've made better things than this with worse parts. Like, just trust the process. And if you do that, it's an important aspect of like the flip side of being really self-critical, is that part. And you do that, it's much easier to do that with people you've had success with or people you've worked with well.
You know, the funny thing to me about that is the process seems to change every time. Like, yeah. I took a couple of jobs, you know, with companies that I didn't know anybody there, primarily because I was curious to see how are other people doing this thing. I mean, how many other ways are there of going after this? Because, you know, television production and feature production, for the most part, you know, obviously budget dependent, but for the most part, it's codified at this point. You know what you're going to do. You know, call sheets pretty much look the same no matter where you are. So this idea of like everyone's inventing their own process on each game. I was on one job where they had meetings to schedule meetings. Like you'd sit in a whole meeting for an hour that the entire substance of that was, what is our meeting schedule going to be for the next month and a half? And I was just looking around going, what? How much talking are we going to do? I mean, is that all we're going to do is just talk? And there was this like territoriality going on where nobody wanted to let everybody else know what they had. Like there was a short story here. I had one day there where I was pitching a level that was in the snow and I was all fired up about The Gray, you know, the Liam Neeson movie, The Gray. Yeah. And I was like, I want to fight wolves. You know, we gotta come out of this, you know, this prison, and we're walking through the snow and we're going to make it back to civilization. And then there's all these wolves and somebody goes, well, we don't have a wolf. And like, are you telling me there's 106 people in this building and nobody's got a wolf? And I don't believe that. And I went around like all day to every designer and I was like, hey, what do you got? Like, do you have a wolf? Is anybody hiding a wolf someplace? No wolves all day. After lunch, this one designer comes walking up to me and says, I don't have a wolf, but I have a dog. And I was like, I'm like, what do you mean you have a dog? And I go over to his workstation and he pulls up. He has 100 hours of mocap of a German Shepherd. So there's a German Shepherd wearing full performance capture suit doing everything. And I'm like, how hard is it to put a wolf skin on this dog? I mean, we could basically have a skeleton of a dog like today, right now. And I went back to everyone at the end of the day and I said, I did not find a wolf, but I've got a dog with no skin. How about that? Can we have that level? Unfortunately, I left town for a little while and the wolf went away. But it was shocking, just the lack of communication. You know, that game did not end up being my favorite. But the ones where people are actually not afraid to talk to each other and communicate, you get a hell of a lot better product.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to, when you're talking about the trust in the process, for both of you, has it gotten easier, like with subsequent games, or do you think it's gotten harder, or like is it different for each game, really?
It's just hard every time. I talked to my buddy Greg Kasavin about this recently.
That's a great interview.
Oh, thanks. And I ended up very much like believing what he had said in that interview, which is just, you're kind of amazed that the success and things you've accomplished in your past are not serving you better in the moment. There are certain things that have gotten easier, and I think I would be remiss, at least in terms of like not making games, but like working at Campo Santo, that to like not identify, which is just, we communicate better. Like we have a shorthand that is really valuable, where we can be like, oh yeah, no, it's like the blank moment in Firewatch, except this is different. Or like, oh, wouldn't it have been better on Firewatch had we done blank instead of blank? Or like we're right now, we're rebuilding our entire like event and writing pipeline actually. But we like can at least go, like we've spent the past 3 days like looking at the way we built every piece of content in Firewatch and going, what did we like about that? What didn't we like about that? So it's easier when you're not starting from scratch in terms of like working at a company. But like for the individual problems on a project, I mean, I can only speak for myself because I've only worked at like two real places. Telltale was really like the process was much more formula and codified than it is at Campo Santo. But like every project is just like its own new nightmare. And if you try to optimize around it not being that, like, oh, we're going to like have a formula and we've cracked the code and we make games in this one specific way, then like you're probably going to make something that feels formulaic and boring.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, you're always looking for ways to improve upon your past mistakes. But unfortunately, sometimes the best stuff comes when you really mess up badly. Like sometimes when you've made something that, you know, you're not quite sure how it works and you're looking for a way to make it work, sometimes you actually come up with good things that way. I mean, the project I was on that was run the smoothest and had, you know, the meetings about meetings, there was just a discernible lack of ingenuity going on and lack of creativity. It was like, let's just hit the benchmarks we have to hit. Let's hit our deliverables. Let's get what we need done. And you didn't have people running in with the crazy idea out of the blue, which are my favorites. I mean, on Modern Warfare, like just from the single player side, we were tweaking that thing all through testing. And when I say tweak, I mean we were completely throwing it out. Like we would come in and it would a level would test better, like the eighth level people would love, and the third level they wouldn't. And like, let's switch them. Let's move that one over here and move this one over there. And does the story still make sense? No, not at all. But we'll find a way to make it make sense. And like some of the best breakthroughs we had just came from like, well, we have to make this work somehow.
Yeah.
I think we all dream of, you know, the smooth, clean, you know, through line from conception to delivery. Some of the speed bumps actually make things better. Unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best you can hope for is just you're not working in endless crunch.
Yeah,
and absolutely. You're being treated with respect and like paid for your services a fair rate. You know, like I feel like if you have those going for you, then like that's pretty good.
That's a good start. Yeah.
Yeah. The process is then like whatever. Like the game is going to have its own unique like pain points. You know, you just hope that you've set yourself up to like deal with those in a way that is not too painful. Yeah.
This is a question for both of you, but since you brought up your talk with Greg, Sean. You talked about the perception that writers have about improving in a linear fashion when it's actually a mix of random paralysis where you set out to climb a mountain and one day your foot doesn't work. So what do both of you do when that happens? And are there places where you feel like you've improved over time now?
Generally, when I feel completely stuck, I try to do a writing podcast with two or three people, such as this one. So I will let you know if that works.
Okay. Please do.
You know, it's like, I don't know, man. It's like the thing I stopped doing that I think was really valuable is I stopped being so mean to myself about having trouble because I've now done it enough where I go, oh, like it was hard every time. And I've been here before and I've been stuck before and I've been sort of listless before. And I have tools to get myself out of it, which are like find inspiration in other things, like go get excited about a part of the project that I'm not responsible for, or like go play another game that just like excites me, where I'm like, oh God, that was like so fun. I just want to go back and play that. And then those sort of like deep feelings of satisfaction will slowly like seep into the work that I'm doing, and I'll find a new angle about like, oh yeah, wait, this is actually really exciting. Or if I'm like stuck and like I just feel really uninspired by the thing I'm working on, I'll like go, well, why? Like I did that yesterday. I went like, oh, I'm uninspired by this because like I set out to do A and I produced B, and B is the opposite of A and it's just sort of like boring and I don't know, like listless. Oh, well, let me go back. A lot of it's just, you just got to work. You got to just try every day and just not be too hard on yourself. It's like going to the gym, you know, like when I leave the gym, I'm usually just like, I kind of like have to remind myself, this is a learned skill, by the way, because I'm very hard on myself at all times. I have to remind myself like just to say like, hey, good job, like going and like working hard, you know? And I do that and it's actually like improved my life considerably. Cause like there are some days you walk out and you feel like Superman. You're like, you don't need to say like good job because you just like did something. You feel like, oh man, I like worked so hard today. And other days you're like, oh God, I gave it, like I tried, you know, but you know,
do you think that the worst writers are the most content with themselves?
Any writers who are content with themselves.
Yeah, no, I don't know what that is.
I've never met someone like that.
Yeah, I know a lot of like attorneys and CPAs who are pretty content with themselves.
I know some writers who are properly medicated, but I mean, I don't know about content.
Yeah, man, no. I don't know.
I'll tell you, you know, the best method I have for that has always been to, and I think this comes from TV, which has much more of a mentor and apprentice kind of history to it, but bring someone else in. Like I, on Modern Warfare 2, I had an assistant named Aaron Tracy, who's now a TV writer, you know, doing pilots for USA and things like that and doing great. And at the time he was just looking for a gig, and I got him to come in, take notes. And then after he'd taken all the notes, I was like, so you know what we need to do, right? You heard all that. He's like, yeah. I'm like, well, you write it. So he would, you know, write whatever it was. We were doing load movies or things like that. At the end of Modern Warfare 2, we had to have a script to submit, you know, for whatever awards considerations. And we didn't write a script. Like, we never had one. So I had, like, Aaron and Steve sat down, and Steve Fukuda, who'd created the game or, you know, designed most of it, played Modern Warfare 2 in its entirety, start to finish, while Aaron Tracy wrote down what happened in script format. Jeez. And we're like,
oh my God.
And we're like, and at the end of a couple of hours, we're like, okay, we've got a script. Let's send that off. And, you know, it was a good training for him and saved That's me a really lot funny. Of hassle. And then after that, I on Titanfall, which was a, you know, a very odd development experience because we didn't do a single player. We didn't have the resources at the time. And we were trying to build in some sort of narrative or, you know, how to tell you about the world. And my assistant at the time was named Manny Hagopian. And I brought him in to sit with me and Steve while we were trying to make up this whole world of grunt chatter. Like, you know, if you stopped and talked to people, they would tell you what was going on. And it became like, you know, I was just trying to get Manny to understand what Steve would like. And I remember we're sitting in my office and Manny sent me a whole bunch of dialogue. And I looked at it and I said, okay, have you read all this out loud? Because Steve's going to. And the next day we're in Steve's office and he's looking at all this dialogue and he's just reading every line out loud, just performing it to himself like he's in his own little zone, which I knew he would do because I'd worked with him for 5 years already. And he liked it. And what he's saying out loud, he liked it. And I said, all right, if you want more of that, get it from Manny. And so then Manny basically ended up, by the second game, getting hired by Respawn to build the entire interactive dialogue system and ended up doing most of my work for me, which I think is the hidden secret in all of these things is everybody's looking for someone to do all their work for them, which is how you kind of keep the train rolling. Is if I can get somebody else to do the stuff that I don't want to do anymore, then I can do other stuff that's, you know, that's bigger. Yeah. And whenever I need inspiration, I just bring somebody else in, start talking about what you're doing, talk about what you're trying to accomplish. And you'll find like, it's like coaching. When you coach, you remember the basics in a way that you might have forgotten them.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. We're doing that on our second game. In a way right now where we have a new person who's helping build a dialogue pipeline. So we're like telling him about why we made all the choices we made the first time. And then I'm actually working with a writer on the second game, Duncan Fife, who does like a lot of our quarterly review stuff. He's like kind of consulting and going to do some writing on the second game as well. And I've never really worked with someone like that before. And it's been really, really helpful when I'm stuck. On the first game, you know, I just bounce like, I would bring like Chris Remo or Jake in during those hard times, and that's usually the only thing that would probably get us out of it. yeah. Chris did like an immeasurable amount of like just soundboarding on Firewatch. It was really, really necessary.
Yeah, you don't have to be alone. You don't have to be
you don't
stuck
have to be
with
alone.
Your misery.
Yes. You have Slack. Have a Slack that has people in it.
Yeah,
yes,
you can. Yes. Don't be so precious about your problems, like staring at them like, only I can solve this. And if I don't, the world's going to end. It's like, bring someone else in to take a look
at it. I firmly believe that being precious about your problems is like not just like unhealthy, but like you're actually like setting yourself up for real failure. Like there's like whatever is making you do that is holding you back in really intense ways. And it's just, you can accomplish way more when you just have a routine of bringing other people into your problems.
This applies to life as well. This is across the board.
Yeah, I agree. 100% agree. There is no... If you right now, listener, are sitting with a problem, personal, professional, or otherwise, tell it to someone and see what happens. I guarantee you it won't get worse.
Yeah.
And if it's the type of problem that will get worse by telling someone it, you've probably committed a capital crime.
Sean, you talked about this earlier a bit, and this is like a question for both of you. Have you found that it's easier to be self-critical about your writing and your work, especially after achieving some kind of success, or can you trust yourself even less now because of that success?
It hasn't really changed. I think like any sort of like the success of Firewatch has been relatively wholly. It wasn't like a fix for anything like that where it's like, oh, now I can be critical because of X. I think I'm pretty much the same person I was before in terms of being self-critical. If anything, it's like reminding ourselves constantly that the success the commercial success of a creative product means two things happened. One, we didn't ship malware, and two, we got lucky. You know, like that people found the game, people responded to the game, and like that luck is all the byproduct of like we didn't sink ourselves before ship with whatever was in the game. So I think we look at the second game and we try to be pretty healthy about it where it goes like, okay, like we've been here before, we've been through hard times, we've been under as much or worse pressure, and we made something that we didn't think was going to be successful and it worked out. Therefore, don't freak out. But also, that doesn't earn you any sort of like, we've got it figured out credit, you know, like we are nothing. We're as good as the last thing we made. And yesterday we made nothing. So just act like, you know, like it's our first day on the job still in terms of the drive and like the ego.
I think it's hard to feel any sort of level of security about it. Like the idea of just cause it's worked before doesn't mean it's going to work again. I'm in a weird position because I'm the only person in the company. I'm the only person at Respawn who doesn't really understand how the computer works. You know, I don't know how any of it gets made. I have I'm basically useless. I guess I have one use. And so I'm really grateful that I've been able to be a part of it and make a contribution at all. And I don't even really see it as any of my success. It feels very curious to me to have been involved in making games that people like, that I've gotten hooked on. And I think 10-year-old me would be very impressed. And I like that part of it. As far as like, does it affect or change the process? I try to stay somewhat usefully ignorant of the process in a lot of ways. Like I don't want to know where all the challenges are coming from because I don't want to be precious about avoiding pitching something that's going to be really hard versus pitching something that's going to be really easy, you know, which is the big learning curve when you go from, you know, the easiest thing to do in TV is write a scene where two people are talking to each other. The hardest thing to do in a video game is write a scene where two people are talking to each other. You know, it's like,
It's exactly right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, we would rather you blew up the earth, you know, that would be cheaper, you know, and you're trying to wrap your head around the differences in terms of,
God, that's 100% true. God, that's 100%. As someone who is currently making a game or makes games where people talk to each other most of the time, yeah. Like,
it's challenging.
It's so refreshing, like, when I'm like, and then a helicopter shows up, and this is on fire, and this explodes. Everyone just goes, like, sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I can see that.
Easy,
yeah.
Easy.
Yeah, I know how to do that. What are you
Thank
talking
God.
About?
We don't have to trick a spreadsheet into pretending to be alive. Thank God. Yeah, and I think a lot of that is, it's funny. I always am like hyper. I think I've had to like develop a skill where, and I think I've done so effectively, where I can both on the one hand be incredibly cognizant of how expensive the thing I'm pitching is, and on the other hand, pitch the wild expensive thing because I trust that if it's the right idea, we'll figure out a way to make it work. I know my buddy Pierre Charette, who is a writer of Tales of the Borderlands and some other Telltale stuff. He and a couple other Telltale guys have just started at Ubisoft, and they've gone from making like episodic games on tight schedules to like they're just making a Ubisoft game, and they're like talking about being in these meetings going like, we don't know, we haven't figured out how to pitch anything expensive yet. Like, is they're making basically I think they're making a AAA game. I don't know what they're making, but it sounds like they're gonna make a AAA game. And it's like, every time we pitch an idea, we're like, oh, but that'll be so expensive. And everyone in the room goes, yeah. Like, of course. What do you think we're doing here? Yeah.
That's great though.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully they'll settle into to that new style of making a game. But,
and like what Jesse was saying before about being ignorant about the process, like, Sean, is there anything that you wish you were ignorant about the development process, or are you happy with how much you know?
No, I feed off of knowing everything. Like, if I know everything, I can do my job way. I can set us up for like lots of different small wins and pieces of success by like knowing what's hard. Like and I think people at Campo Santo will tell you this. Like, there's a few things that I will get like really like annoyed about. I try not to be very annoyed. I try to be really easygoing about stuff as much as I can. But like, if there's a secret problem that people have just been slamming their fucking faces against for a while and they didn't tell like someone else or the rest of the team, oh, it drives me nuts. Like, I want to know how everything works because like, it's stuff like, oh, like, hey, if doing that sort of like interaction is easy for us, well, guess what? I actually think they're really high yield in terms of how satisfying they are to do as a player. So I can like optimize this chunk of the story around doing more stuff like that. Whereas if someone comes to me later and goes, oh, you know, every time you like wrote in the script that like blank would happen, that's really, really hard. And like every one of those is like handmade and awful. Then I'm like, well, why didn't you say something when I was writing it? I wouldn't have done that. You know? Yeah. Yeah. It's like taking a kid to a fancy dinner and they just order like 7 lobsters. Yeah.
Did it change when you became a co-founder? Like, were you worried about more stuff now?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, because like there becomes a time where I just go like, hey guys, we don't have any money. Who wants to leave first? That's never happened, but you know, that's always the thing that like that's where everything inevitably leads. I think Jake and I were able. I think we built a lot of trust with the core team, and were able to like accomplish things at Telltale that. Maybe some other folks struggled with, because we had a knack, it was my natural inclination to, for an hour to 2 hours a day, get out of my desk and just like walk around and be like, hey, what's that? What are you working on? What's that? What's that? Mm-hmm. What's that? And not because like, there's two sort of things, right? When you're working at a studio that's, you know, 50 to 100, now Telltale's like 300, whatever, like you're sitting there working. And then there's the feeling of your producer coming over, and you see it in your periphery, and you see him or her like wander up, and your entire body tenses, and you get like, you feel like that tiny little gem of annoyance begin. And then they're like, hey, how's it going? And you're like, good. Like, oh, what are you working on? And you're like, this. And you know it's just bullshit. It's like a friend calling you to borrow money. You know they're just getting ready to be like, so I just wanted to check in and see how blank was coming and if you were going to be able to hit Tuesday. Yeah, I'm going to hit Tuesday. Tuesday's going to be fine. I'll hit Tuesday. Don't worry about it. Just please go, you know, because they just want like they're like at the schedule and they want to make sure that like you're going to be done on time, and it's the worst. Versus like when you're sitting there and someone comes over and goes, hey, man, that's really cool. And you're like, what? And you're like, oh, that's really neat. Like, I like what you're doing with that. And like, you'll talk to an artist and she's like just been sitting there like crunching on something and only had people be like, do it faster. And you can come over and be like, hey, like, how is that to work on? Like, is that like, I think that's neat. Are you enjoying that? oh, like, oh, hey, like, by the way, on the third episode, like, I'm thinking there's going to be like this thing. You should probably work on that if you like stuff like this. And they're like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, yeah, I'm definitely going to like make sure that stays in the script. So like when the art team, when art meetings come, like tell so-and-so that you want to work on it. I'm like, oh, sweet. You know, like, and then I just kind of walk around and go like, oh, you're working on this? What's that like? What's that like? And you get a sense for like what people like to work on and like what people think they're good at and what people think they're bad at and then what you know they're good at and what you know they're bad at. And you can like hyper optimize from a creative director level to like work to like make all that stuff like happen. And I, like Jake is really, really good at that. I think I'm pretty good at it. And I think that's been a lot of that was like I can attribute that to a lot of the success I've had, which ultimately boils down to your question of like, no, just know everything that's going on. But you have to know, you have to want to know about it from like a genuinely curious, like interest, like interested place, not from the, like, I want to control everything place. Cause if you would try to control everything while working on a video game, you're gonna like fucking flip out. You're gonna snap and you're gonna have a, like, it's going to be real ugly when it happens.
We have at Respawn, they do a period at the top of a new development cycle where it's basically just play for every one of the leads. You know, they get to just either design a mechanic or present a creature or a world or anything that's in their head, whether it's a weapon or anything that it doesn't have to connect to anything. And there'll be a period of, you know, a few weeks where people are just kind of working on whatever their pet project is. And then we kind of have a bake-off, you know, where people present the stuff and see what really clicks. And whether we know how the pieces are going to fit together or not, if it's awesome, if it's cool, then we'll figure it out and down the line. And on Titanfall 2, the time shift level,
started. Fuck like you that. Guys, by the way. That thing's awesome. God damn it.
Is that great? I mean,
yeah, it's fucking great. It's really goddamn great.
Yeah,
it's well done.
that started with one of our designers, Jake, who just had this vision of here's how it's gonna go, you know. But as far as how it fit into the greater world, it was like we knew, okay, you push a button and you're in the same space, different time. Push a button and you're back in the previous space. And that was one of the biggest challenges from a narrative point of view on that game was, all right, how do we set it up so that this fits in this game without completely turning the entire game into time travel? You know, it had to be isolated to just one level. And within that level, it had to be introduced, played with, kind of evolve a bit and get to a point where ultimately you could leave the player still wanting more after it was done. So we didn't want it to, you know, as much as we loved it, we didn't want it to take over the entire game completely. And that was one of the biggest questions from a narrative point of view. I don't know what the answer was. Time anomaly. We had a time anomaly.
It totally works.
Thank God. God, it played.
I think what both of you are talking about also relates to what we were talking about earlier, and that like communication helps everything. Just like talk to everyone, not any kind of ulterior motive. Just like, hey, that looks cool, or I want to talk to you about this, and not about like your deadlines. Like, it just helps everyone and makes morale improve. And
yeah, but there still is. There has to be an incubation period. I mean, it's like cooking. It's like you can't just everybody run in the kitchen at the same time. It's like somebody has to be in there, get things going, and then you go, all right, come smell this, taste this, see if you like it.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, it's like really, it's. And you develop sort of like a good sense for so much of our work, because we have two people in England, a person in Seattle, part-time person in Portland, contractor in New Zealand, contractor in Shanghai.
That's crazy.
Yeah, we're like all over. The Shanghai contractor is just like kind of working on like a port actually right now, so it's not like I talk to him all the time. Part in the Portland person is all like business operation stuff. So like the core team is actually like only 12 at Campo. But the point is we like between like Slack and like we use Zoom, which is like basically like Google Hangouts, but better. Between those two things, like it just means people can work like wherever they want to work, whenever they want to work. And you kind of build a sense for like, all right, how often do we all need to be talking to each other? okay, I'm going to pitch this crazy thing. Do I put that in the Slack channel that has everyone in it? Do I just say something out loud on Zoom? Because everyone has, like, even if you're in the same office, like everyone in the San Francisco office, and there's seven of us there, have a like webcam and microphone at our desks. So like, even though Jake sits like 8 feet away from me, I like look to my second monitor and I like see his face if he has his camera on. But everyone always has their audio on, at least listening, and is muted. So we're always just like, you can just like, I can hit a button and go, hey, what does everybody think about this? And then everyone in the organization, no matter where they are in the world, has to listen to me. but like, it's like, you get a real sense for like which of those channels to use and like, okay, is this idea like ready for everyone to hear? Because as soon as everyone hears it, like some people are going to start like budgeting their time against it. Other people are going to like want to like really like tease it apart, and you kind of start to get a sense for especially when you're small, as few people as us, like when do you share those things to optimize its like success inside of the company, whether it's an idea for a story or a level or a mechanic or whatever.
When do you?
It depends. It's everything's different. You know, like I am working on a bunch of character backstory stuff right now. And I was like, okay, like this is like too intricate and too like fiddly for me to just dump it in the general story channel in Slack, or for me to like have an open meeting about it at the company. So like, I will just throw like Chris and Duncan in a channel together on Slack and be like, hey guys, like I'm struggling with this character backstory stuff. Here's where I'm at. What do you guys think? And this is what I think I'm going to, this is where I think I'm going to land. Does that seem right to you? And then when they're kind of bought in, I can figure out a way to like communicate that to the rest of the team. And like, we don't write docs. We don't write like sit down and write scripts. We have like a zero document like policy almost at the company. So like, if you're trying to communicate something to the company or to other people on a broad level, we usually like, I will make a game. Or something that everyone at the studio has started doing that is so cool is that they will turn on their webcam, turn on like XSplit or like Fraps or something, and then just make like a 1 to 2 minute video of like, let me show you this idea. And they will walk through like everything in that idea, like in Engine. They'll like bring up like images from the web and be like, okay, so it's going to look like this and like that. And then like drop that little video.
I have no segue for this question, but for both of you, do you think subtlety is hard to pull off in games?
I mean, I think subtlety is hard in writing, like straight up, like period. And, you know, I think games being like, if you look at their history and like where games began, they were like, you know, like basically like puzzles, challenges, races, and then like combat. And nothing about any of those things is like particularly subtle. So it's maybe a little bit harder, but I mean, it's hard to go see like a really like elegant, subtle, but also an entertaining movie. Like people, like I think the bigger problem is that people like mortgage fun and entertainment for subtlety. And I'm like, those aren't mutually exclusive, man. Like stop doing that.
God, that is such a good point. I mean, it's like, yeah, job one is entertain, you know, and if you want to get a message in there, you know, you got to smuggle it. You always got to smuggle your meaning underneath something fun. There are, I think it depends on the game mechanic, really. If you're playing a first-person shooter, particularly, you know, something that moves really fast, how are you going to encourage someone to slow down and take in something that they might have missed? I think the beautiful thing about people who play a lot of games is they explore in ways you don't anticipate. Like, it's fascinating to watch, you know, when you launch a game and you watch the community basically try to break it, you know, on the first weekend, like find every hole that you've left unfilled. So there's a curiosity, there's a deep curiosity for gamers to explore. But then you have to have an actual, you know, a game mechanic that encourages that, that encourages moving slowly and uncovering hidden things and lingering in moments and wanting to experience that, which I think is close to impossible in a first-person shooter, has occasionally been achieved. I think one of the moments that I'm most proud to have been involved in was the No Russian level in Modern Warfare 2, where we had this awful idea of, let's see if what it feels like to be in the shoes of a terrorist, you know, which from my perspective was something like, we talk about this like it's monstrous, but really these are humans. Terrorists are humans. So let's see if we can find a way to relate to the monstrosity. And that level elicited a response in people that was basically disgust. Like, oh, why do you want me to do this? Oh, this is awful. And then, you know, the level would start and everybody would open fire, which exposed some really interesting things about human nature and also about emotions that could be elicited from a game experience. Like, I didn't know prior to that you could feel disgust from a video game. That was new and it was interesting. So as far as subtlety, it's like I'm more interested in getting some emotional response beyond rage, beyond fury. Like, is there anything that someone could feel right here in this experience that isn't just, you know, bloodthirsty rampage?
Mm-hmm. And I assume another factor that's like different than film or literature is that in film, you know what the audience will be focusing on. In video games, especially with 3D games where you can control the perspective, it's you don't know what the player will be focusing on at all. You have to try to like wave at them and get them like, hey, you should look over here right now. But there's no guarantee that they'll do that at any time.
I mean, you have really powerful tools, though, to be like, I know exactly where you're looking at all times. Yeah. You know, like, I can just like flip the script, right? As opposed to being like, oh, how do we make them look at this thing? It's like, no, just put a thing where they're looking. You know, like, you can do pretty exciting stuff with that.
Yeah.
There's like reactive dialogue in Firewatch like that, where Delilah's like, where are you? What are you looking at? And Henry will just be like, I'm looking at your tower. And you're like, what? Because like, you are.
We use a tool in testing where, you know, you put the camera on people's heads and it puts the heat spots on the actual screen where their attention is. So you can watch the playback of testing and it'll track exactly where the tester's eye line was, which I find like the coolest thing in the world. And, you know, for the most part, they're looking where you expect that they're looking.
Yeah. The thing you can't control, to your point, is that you can't control what order they're going to look at things in.
Right.
And, you know, anybody who takes like a film 101 class will like be able to like recite to you like Sergei Eisenstein's like discovery that like A plus B creates meaning C, you know, via montage. So you lose that in some cases, you know. It's like why a lot of like, I think it's a smart decision to tell a really complicated story with in first person in a game with corridors, because you have to move through them, you know? So like the story of Half-Life 1, Half-Life 2, like Davey Reedon's The Beginner's Guide. I mean, it's flipped on, like Davey uses that entire idea in the Stanley Parable, Portal, BioShock, like can have this like more traditional film structure to their story because you're walking forward, you know, through it. Basically a corridor becomes your timeline. It was a little harder in Firewatch because it was there were no corridors in the woods. Yeah.
I think we're going to be, that'll close out this episode, but we have to have a brief bit for you, Sean, to explain your experience working on War Inspector's Epic Mickey before we do that.
I never worked on War Inspector's Epic Mickey. I worked on the Walt Disney Corporation's Mickey Epic. Yeah, when I was an intern at Disney, my boss had sort of like one of his like white whales for like for a video game to get into production. Like his job was basically like find strategic opportunities for Disney to take an IP or a thing that was like in film production and get it into a video game format at the right time. So it's like, oh, the company's working on a Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Can we get a game out inside of its release window that like helps that entire franchise? Like, you know, like they're very like, that was their, like they wanted to synergize their their lines of business. I almost said LOBs. and like, so like, whatever, like not a thing I'm super interested in, but kind of curious to watch how that works. And one of those things for, it was like on the not synergy side was like, he'd always wanted to figure out a way to get Mickey into like, into a game that was like relevant. And like, why isn't Mickey like as like, and why isn't Mickey an evergreen like video game property the way like Mario or like Zelda is? Like, it doesn't really make any sense. And to that point, I actually really agreed. And we kind of like got to work on this thing that was like all going to be about like celebrating like the history of the company, like the forgotten history of the company, and going to be a like third person action platformer with, this is like what we're working on. This isn't what we, this isn't what shipped. Third person like Zelda, like it was going to be like basically an Ocarina of Time alike, where you played Mickey exploring this like unknown world and ended up like walking through the sort of forgotten history of the Walt Disney Company along the way. I worked on that for 2.5 years.
Wow.
It was flipping crazy. I was like going to school and I would show up at Disney at like 2:30 in the afternoon and work till like 7:30 or 8 at night. And, like writing and creative, like basically like assistant creative directing to my boss. We got a budget and we found a third party, like some guys who had had experience at places like Insomniac to like build a prototype. Yeah, we worked on it for a long time. And the thing that I learned is that to get anything done at a big company like Disney, you have to be very loud. And you have to be very, very, you have to be very controlling of the core vision, because the company is so big and sprawling that people who can affect your life, who work in other buildings, will hear about your idea before you're able to tell it to them, and then start to imagine what it is before they know what it is. And that sort of was like the story of Mickey. And it kind of became this thing where it's like, oh no, it's going to be like this dark wasteland where people go. And I remember when that kind of like came back through like some meetings, like, oh yeah, so-and-so it like whatever sees it as like this, like as this, I was like, oh my God, that's not totally not right. And I got this like education in sort of how to communicate creative ideas across like a really like broad organization that I think really helped me at a place like Telltale, because Telltale was small, but still needed like stakeholder buy-in to like do like big tricky shit. And, yeah, I mean, we worked on it for a long time, built a crazy prototype that I always really loved. And then I think what happened is the company itself, like Bob Iger had just was transitioning into becoming a CEO. My boss and I like had a meeting with Bob Iger and some of the senior old Walt Disney Corporation like team, our Walt Disney Company like corporate team. Bob was there, a couple other people were there, and he really liked it. And then once like basically, I remember walking out of that meeting, and I was a senior at USC, and I was like, "Wow, my boss and I just pitched something to Bob Iger. Crazy." that happened earlier than I thought it would happen, and he really liked it. And then I remember my boss kind of being nervous, and I was like, "Oh, I wonder why he's nervous." And now I know the day Bob Iger liked that idea, like I was never going to work on it again, you know. And that's exactly what happened, you know. Like I was like taken off of it and moved on to something else, and it languished for about a year and a half. And then right as I was leaving the company, it was announced that like Warren Spector would be making it. And I was like, that's interesting. And off I went. And then it was launched as Epic Mickey. And I was like, what? They got the words backwards. I mean, it makes more sense as Epic Mickey, but I always liked Mickey Epic as like a better name. Actually, weirdly, I just opened the desk drawer in my office, and there's a really funky kind of badly made white pin, like a badge, like those sort of like paper like on tin badges. Yeah. Like a round badge that has the Mickey Epic logo or Epic Mickey logo on it, and I drew that logo. That like drippy ink like, yeah, Mickey ears thing. Yeah. Was a sketch I did on my notebook, and then we couldn't find a logo, so we scanned it. and it's the logo that we shipped with. And now it's like here, been through some Photoshop filters on this badge, and it says Circle C Disney on it. And that is really funny to me.
That probably happens more than people would think.
I have no artistic skills. Zero. But
of things like, we couldn't find the real thing, or just like, yeah, we'll do put this out there and then fix it later.
Yeah, we just threw it on the top cover of the PowerPoint or the design document or whatever. Like it was very like design document, very PowerPoint heavy company. And that is where I learned that I was never going to have a company that relied on the Microsoft suite of products.
That's
Excel.
A good note to end
we
on.
Use Excel. We use Excel a lot. Because that's how you count your money.
Don't use Microsoft suite. That's a good way to end this.
Yeah. Jesse, it was a pleasure actually getting to chat with you on this. It was you're a fascinating guy, and I'm like really a big fan of your work. And I think you have like really cool things to say about the job, and really enjoyable.
Well, thanks, man. It was nice talking to you too. You know a hell of a lot more than I do.
No, just different.
I just learned about myself that I stay willfully ignorant to certain things. I didn't know that before we had this conversation.
See, look at all the joy that this podcast brings. Self-realizations, like knowledge share.
Yes, well meditation. I'm sure it'll be lovely to meditate too.
Briefly, could you point out to our listeners where can people find you on the internet or like find you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter at Jesse Stern, JesseSTern. That's about it.
All right, Sean.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Vanaman, and you can keep up with what I'm working on by following Campo Santo at Campo Santo. We also have a cool blog and a cool quarterly review literary magazine that if you like to read stuff about video games, I highly recommend subscribing to. It is free.
Nice.
You can find that at quarterly.camposanto.com.
And the latest issue just came out like last week.
Yeah, I'm really happy with that one.
And you can find this podcast at ScriptLockCast on Twitter. And with that, thank you two again for coming on.
Goodbye. Thanks so much for having me. It was really fun.
Thanks, guys.